Hello and welcome to ELT Under the Covers Crumbs on the Sheets, where we take a broader look at the education, learning and teaching industry community, and we go a little bit more in depth into topics that are on our minds and have been suggested by you, our viewers. But first, introductions. I'm Neil of Team Teacher.
Hello everybody, it's Professor Rich.
Rich, we're back at it. We've got more crumbs on the sheets. Time to vacuum them up.
You know, they get everywhere, don't they?
Yeah.
You get onto all kinds of places on your physical, corporeal body. And then you have to have a shower. And
so what's on the agenda today? I figure a good starting place would be to deal with the aftermath of our interview with Anthony Hocking. If you have any thoughts or points during that talk where we talked extensively about mental health in teaching and outside, that you
when you said
like to bring up
when you said aftermath, I just kind of thought like, whoa, it sounds like, you know, the industry was turned on its head and we made national news and all those people got fired. I mean, that would have been great, wouldn't it?
I am walking, talking clickbait, so
the bombshell, yeah. So basically follow up to that. Well, I think we could have kept talking for quite a while about
that. Oh god.
He had some
really
passionate things to say about the industry and mental health. Occupational burnout was sort of where he kind of targeted it, didn't he? And I can't remember if I actually said at the time, but the specific area of occupational burnout that I could really relate to is this kind of loss of passion due to institutional limitations. And that's a part I can really relate to, and it's one of the things I'm struggling with right now, because the institution that I work with follows a very prescriptive syllabus, and there's a few issues with it, and it's be very difficult to change. So basically we're teaching something that we call Skills for Life, and it's English as a second language. So it's these are learners who are in the country, living here. Some of them are working here, and they are learning English to get this qualification from the government. But also, you know, it's probably about 50-50 or 60-40 or something. The percentage of students who are kind of doing it for themselves, and the percentage of students are doing it because they want the piece of paper to go on and do something else.
What's the piece of paper allow them to do?
Well, if you get the very top level, or sometimes the second to top level, then the piece of paper at the very least allows you to study other courses. So for example, if you want to do A-levels, or you want to do like a HND or something like that, then you can prove your English using the level one or level two ESOL qualification. It's only recognized in the UK, so you can't then go to France and show them it. They won't care. And that's deliberate, because the government subsidizes the program and they want people who go through the program to stay in the UK.
The so people they that go through the program, are they paying for the program? Or is it?
It depends on personal circumstance. If you earn under a certain amount, which I believe is about £20,000, then you either don't have to pay, or you only have to pay part of it.
Oh, okay.
Also, if you're under the age of 19, you don't have to pay. Or if you are a refugee or asylum seeker, you also don't have to pay, unless you're working. If you're working, you still have to pay. So if you're a refugee, which means you're legally recognized here, then you could be working and you may have to pay. So it depends on the criteria. But what you have to pay is really cheap. So it's still, even when you pay, it gets subsidized.
Oh, okay.
Right? You're not paying the full cost.
Right.
So compared to a private language academy, it's really cheap. So it's a really cheap course. So demand is high. People queue up to try and get into
and
the college.
It's very important that we demand high.
That's right. There's a waiting list of about 9 months.
Oh,
so
wow.
even if you come to the college and you're like, I want to study, here's take my money. They'll be like, well, you're going to have to wait. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a waiting list of about 9 months to get onto any course. And yeah, the issue is they're teaching to a government syllabus, and the government syllabus, the specific exam body that we use, I don't know if I want to sort of mention names since I'm actually working at the institution.
Yeah,
at the moment,
so I don't want to
rock the boat. Yeah, I don't want to rock the boat too much. But anyway, the exam body that we're working with, it's grammar-based criteria in all instances, including speaking. So, you know, for example, the criteria says, this is one of the achievement criteria. So this is one mark that they must get, mm-hmm. right? And it says, uses language appropriate to the level for narrating, explaining, asking for information, giving instructions, and making requests. So far, that's okay. And then it says, for example, perfect tenses, conditionals, modals, phrasal verbs, active and passive voices appropriate, a variety of simple, compound, and complex sentences, uses a range of adjectives, intensifiers, adverbial, and prepositional phrases appropriate to the level. See, that's where I start to have a bit more of a problem with it, when it's the way it's saying stuff like that. So one of the other criteria says, asks appropriate questions using a variety of question forms in past, present, and future tenses. So this is like a presentation, mm-hmm. and then the other students ask questions. But it says, ask appropriate questions using a variety of question forms in past, present, and future tenses. So they have to like synthetically ask a variety of questions using different forms.
Right.
You know, okay. So they have to say, oh, you said this before. Is that what you meant? Oh, what are you going to do in future about this? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you have to actually deliberately put that stuff in because that's what the criteria says. Mm-hmm. I don't like it at all. I really don't like that. It's so synthetic and clunky. Mm-hmm. And I really don't like the tasks that they come up with. Mm-hmm. Like a presentation, fair enough. Presentation skills are useful. And I don't have a big issue with that. But then there's what they call discussion, but it's actually a role play. And okay. A role play for a speaking exam, I have issues with that, mm-hmm. because it's not real. Just make it real. Look, I'm a teacher, you're a student, we're going to talk about something, and I'll use that to assess your speaking. I don't need to say, right, I'm a shopkeeper and you're not happy with a product you brought last month, so now you're going to come in and ask for a refund, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, what the hell's that? It's like, I don't know. I'm not keen on that. It might be a fun activity to do in class, but, you know, it just seems a bit daft having that kind of thing in an exam. So because of that, you know, it really affects what we need to teach, because the primary metrics, I might have mentioned this before, the primary mm-hmm. metrics on which the college is judged, and therefore it all filters down, obviously, all the way to the teacher level, are pass rate, one. Two, attendance. So number one thing is pass rate. Mm-hmm. And our pass rate currently is about 90%.
Right.
Right? So 90% of our students pass in either the first time or resits. That includes resits. So we could say only 10%. That includes dropping out. So only 10% drop out or don't pass the exam. That's from the full percentage of students who start the course. So it's very high pass rate, really, because, you know, normally you get people dropping out. If you're doing Cambridge English, you don't even put all the students in for the exam, but all of ours have to go in for the exam. If they do the course, they go in for the exam. So it's a really high pass rate, and that's our primary metric, and we're really wanting them to pass. So we have to, you know, backwash is obligatory. It's not like you don't have a choice. Unless you're just really confident that the students are going to pass, or you don't give a rat's, which, you know, is not good, is it? You've got to, in whatever metric you're being judged as an employer, it's very difficult to, you know, not just ignore that. I mean, it's not going to go well for you in the long run, is it? So you have to get those pass rates. You have to keep them up. And so, you know, at some point, I'm going to have to make sure that my students know that they're going to have to ask questions in a variety of past, present, and future tenses in a presentation. Mm-hmm. And I hate it because that's not the way I teach, right? So it's like going to a musician who plays rock music and saying, like, right, I want you to perform Baroque, you know?
Yeah.
You're going to do the Baroque
it's
dance.
It's a little bit of rock, but it's got a more bra at the front.
It's got a bar. It's rock after you've got drunk. That'd be good, wouldn't it? No, but that's the point.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, is where I can really relate to Anthony's talk on occupational burnout, because that's when I really feel burnt out, because it's like, it's not the way I teach. It's not why I'm a teacher. And it's just really, you know, it's even worse than having to do all of the admin-y stuff that teachers hate, like marking exams and designing syllabuses and answering emails and stuff like that. Having someone come up to you and saying, this is how you have to teach and this is what you have to teach, is the biggest killer of my enthusiasm to go into the classroom. Mm-hmm. And if I then go into the classroom and I know that I have to do something like that, I just want to get it out the way, and I feel cynical about it. And I think it even comes off with the students as well. I mean, I find it, I have kind of a loose tongue anyway, so I find it hard not to just tell the students that I think something's bullshit as well. So I'll just, as I'm even saying it to them, I'll just be like, it's such bullshit, you have to do this. You know, it's like,
well,
that's
why
not
can't,
good
why
either.
Can't you say that?
Well, it's just a bit negative, isn't it? I suppose, you know, I mean, you don't want students to be too negative about an exam, because that can come off badly. You know, if a student goes into an exam and they think the exam's bullshit, then that could,
some
circumstances.
I say because I've done it when I've taught IELTS, and I've had people that are what need to pass IELTS to go to university, but they're doing sports, you know, science or something, sort of sport or art, and they're like, why am I writing these essays? I'm like, because you've got to pass the exam. I'm sorry. I mean, yeah. It's the system.
That's a good point. I mean, particularly what comes to mind actually for IELTS is the writing task one, where you have to analyze a process or data table or graph and describe the main characteristics of it. I mean, if you're going to university to study philosophy, then that entire skill set is near enough useless.
Yeah.
So it is, it's interesting. Again, just an issue with exams. There's so many things that I could say about exams. I think there is a way of reforming the exam system, but it's really quite depressing that, you know, I don't want to use current year, but that's really where I are. It's really quite depressing that in 2023, oh my God, you know, we still have this sort of prescriptive grammar-based exams going around, because this stuff really was argued out of court in the 1990s. You know, I mean, the lexical approach and all that kind of stuff, it all come on, and everyone was talking about authentic materials and stuff like that. And, you know, it does give people a bit of a headache at first. So one of my early jobs in my career living in Valencia was, I worked at the, it was just after you left. I went and worked at the Universidad Politécnica de Valencia, the UPV, and they were on board with a copy of Cambridge English called ACLES, but with a fundamental difference that ACLES was really focused on, and probably still is actually, really focused on authentic materials. And what they meant by that is any material that's used in their exam, and that goes for listenings as well, must be from an authentic source. Now, they did actually re-record the listenings. So the listenings were recorded by actors, in fact, teachers. I'm on some of them, or I was. Had to go into the recording studio and do it. So I didn't. That wasn't particularly good, because that's never that natural. But the idea that the script should be unedited and taken from the real world, you know, and also the same for the readings. You can't edit the readings. It has to be just a newspaper article as is, or whatever, right? And when I first kind of come up against that, I was like, oh God, that's a bit of a pain, isn't it? It's so much easier if you can just adapt texts and stuff like that. But, you know, many years later, I agree with that now. I think that's good. And I think that's really the way we should be doing things. Don't make it too sugar-coated. Because there's ways of scaffolding real text. There's ways of presenting it in a bite-sized format that allows even beginners to deal with something that's at least real. You know, I mean, you can find signs and stuff like that, you know, a sign in a hospital that gives the instructions for the fire escape or something like that. That's real language. You're not editing it, and you can do stuff with that with any level. of English learner. And, you know, I believe in that now, and I can really see the utility of it. I needed to be convinced, though. It did take me a while. So I can understand why people still kind of balk at it and don't want to do it and all the rest of it. But I just wish that it was the way we were doing things, and I wish everyone would do it as well. Because really, we do need kind of a systematic revolution or systemic revolution in that regard. Because otherwise, you get the students coming in and they react badly to it. And it's so much, the amount of time I've had to spend like convincing and turning students around to sort of my way of thinking, it gets annoying at some stage, you know. Mm-hmm. Every new student you get, you know, you give them some authentic stuff and they're like, oh, I don't understand. Oh, why are you speaking so fast? You know, and stuff like that. And it's like, because they've been trained to think that accuracy is paramount. They have to understand every single word, otherwise it's a waste of time. They have to speak perfectly, you know, and they've been trained on the kind of exam tick box system. They want to learn the present perfect and things like that. And you have to kind of teach them out of it. Yeah. And to come full circle on this, the frustrating thing is that currently the primary metric on which my job is valued by my institution is a prescriptive grammar-based test. Mm-hmm. And so it goes completely against the flow of the way that I think we should be taking the students.
Okay.
And as I said, anyway, that ACLES was doing that like 15 years ago. Probably they still are, hopefully. And then the British government's doing this, just this tick box style system.
Okay. I think I can cut away a lot of chaff, not like I'm saying your stuff is chaff, but, you know, like to make it a little bit more succinct and kind of give an overview and summary of what you're saying. So here's my perspective, and I absolutely 100% agree what you're doing is correct. It's the correct way we should be focusing on. But that aside, what I'm looking at is what we have is your employer let's go even further back. The course that you're teaching, what they get out of the focus of this course is to get this certificate, so they can go on to do other things. It's not necessarily that they are to learn English communicatively. That seems like a happy byproduct. The institution is aligned with the employer and the whole educational system to make sure that students pass in this exam and get the certificate, and even the students themselves are focused on passing the exam and getting the certificate. And then so there's all of this all together over here, and then there's Rich that's doing the correct way of saying you're trying to learn English, you're trying to communicate in English, this is what you do to communicate in English. All of this over here is what you do to get a piece of paper. These are not the same thing. They don't even really intertwine that much at all. So all of this is against you. At what point with institutional burnout do you go, well, I just have to remove myself from this? Because, you know, you're fighting everything. There's nothing on your side whatsoever. So my thoughts are, should it not be the case that you either remove yourself from that situation, or you find a happy medium to be able to do what you want to do, but also, you know, beat to the drum of all this other institution, societal ideas, etc.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's probably the dilemma of anyone who's suffering from institution.
Any good teacher that cares about their
burnout.
Yeah.
Well, anyone who suffers from occupational burnout. Yeah, that's true. Even Anthony was sort of hinting at that himself, wasn't he? He was saying he kind of felt like he had one foot out the door, I think.
Yeah.
In the place where he was currently working. I mean, yeah, it is like that. And he said, you know, if you push against it, you get known as the troublemaker. And that's exactly right as well. You know, I've eased off in my kind of open criticism of this stuff, especially when coordinators around, they're lovely people. And I don't think that they would consciously hold a grudge about it. But I can tell that if I keep rubbing against the sandpaper, then, you know, eventually there's going to be, I don't know, there's going to be a wound to start appear, right? So, yeah, I've took my foot off the kind of public stuff. And then you get a bit of an issue because it's like, well, how are we ever going to change anything? Well, in my circumstance, first of all, I don't think you're quite right when you said everything's against you. It's not like that, because you have to realize.
It seems that way.
You know, well, it does, because I haven't really mentioned I haven't given the full picture. Although they are the primary metrics that we're measured on, there is student feedback. So there is the students' feeding back. Also, I did mention not all the students actually just want the piece of paper. Mm-hmm. As I said, probably about 40% are there just to learn. Primarily aim is to learn. You don't even really care that much about the exam. And you have to make them care, because the college wants this high pass rate, right? So, you know,
that must be incredibly frustrating to you, because you've got some students that are absolutely aligned with you, and you're like, yeah, but you should still care. You're like,
yeah, I mean, I'm
a simp for the institution.
Well, I had a student who failed the exam and isn't continuing because you know, she's got too much work or something, and I had to convince her to come in and do a resit. And she's like, well, what's the point? I'm not continuing. And I'm like, yeah. But eventually what I said was, well, in the future, you might continue and you wouldn't want to have to repeat the whole semester again. So you might as well come in and resit. And she did. And she come in and she resit and she passed. So, okay. But she definitely didn't need that piece of paper. And yeah, so as you can see, I have to do these things. It's not totally against my principles to get someone to come in and resit. You might as well not wait, you know, you might as well get the piece of paper. It's only half an hour of your time or whatever at the end of the day. But still, yeah, it's annoying. I think we do have to accept that there's always going to be things that aren't, you know, we can't kowtow to what every single individual teacher wants in an institution. That's not how institutions work. Mm-hmm. You know, there always has to be some sort of compromise. So my current perspective is, yes, I think there is cause to be thinking, well, perhaps the grass is greener and I have to keep my eye out with that. Sure, I think that is the way people should think. Because what we don't want is we don't want to lose our passion for teaching.
No.
Obviously, it is possible to do that, because you only have to go and look at teachers in general. You know, show me a room full of teachers, and I'm sure I could get a whole group of those teachers and very easily see how disillusioned they are with the profession, and they're just doing it for a job and so on and so on. And maybe some of them started out like that, but I don't think everyone starts out like that. So no one wants to become that, because what is the point then? If teaching becomes a job, you've got a real problem, I think. Mm-hmm. It's not a profession which suits being a job. You know,
yeah.
I'm not really someone who believes in jobs anyway, but, you know, someone has to clean the toilets, someone has to do whatever. So there are some things that you just do for the money, right? Well, if teaching becomes like that, we've got a big problem. So you have to do something about when this situation arises. So, yeah, I do think one of the things is keeping an eye out. And that's made quite tough by jobs like the one that I've currently got, where, ooh, they've got a nice pension and it's very secure and da 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 da. You know, people love jobs like that, don't they?
Yeah.
They love to sit in them for decades. And that doesn't help either, which comes to one of my kind of controversial and potentially self-harming kind of visions for the future of teaching. But I'll get onto that in a minute. I just want to finish my thought about what individual teachers should do if they're in this situation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, one is, yeah, you keep an eye on the job market. Sure. Looking for, you know, if a job comes up at a college down the road and it's like, and we believe in authentic materials and, groundbreaking exams that simulate authentic English and real situations or whatever, then yeah, I'm probably going to be interested and start inquiring. So yeah, you've got to keep an eye out. The other thing though, is you can push for change and things do change sometimes, but there's a right way and a wrong way of doing it. And the wrong way is to just start bleating about it in the teacher's room every day. You know, that's the wrong way because it's unlikely to do anything. You're going to create resistance, going to come up against problems. You have to find out what the source of the kind of the ground, the base reason why things are the way they are, and then tackle it there. So, and obviously the college is not going to do anything which goes against its interests. So the thing is, what do the government look at? They're going to look at attendance and pass rates. That's why they're so concerned about that. So one possible solution could have been for me to say, why don't we stop using this exam board and use another exam board which does use authentic materials? But the thing is, the only way I'd be able to sell that to the decision makers is by saying that also that it'll be better for our pass rates. And that's extremely difficult to do given that our pass rates are currently 90%. Because they were doing Cambridge English, I think 90% would be a damn good pass rate for an institution. I don't know. I've not really looked at the pass rates for Cambridge English and whatever. So it'd be very difficult to sell a different exam board. So then the only other possibility is to actually go directly to the exam board and try to convince them. And honestly, you know, that's talking about my specific situation. You have to translate this into whatever is the cause of your particular teacher occupational burnout. And by the way, I don't feel like I have occupational burnout. I just have this element of it. But yeah, I mean, that is what I feel I need to do. I'm probably going to write a letter and I'm going to send it to the
You're doing the exact same thing that you said that no one's going to do.
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. But it is true that pretty much no one ever does it.
Yeah, it's true.
That's probably what will count on my side. I mean, I might even write the letter and get a few other teachers to sign it. So, you know, it's got a couple of signatures on there. And I will argue the case. And to be honest, I'm almost certain that it will have zero effect. And I'm not even sure that they'll respond. They might. And if they do respond, that'll be interesting because they might try and justify the way they do things, which is fair enough. Mm-hmm. But to kind of go back to what you've said and probably what you're predicting here, all I'm really doing is kicking the can down the road. I'm sort of partly keeping myself happy by lodging some form of protest. And I'm well aware that eventually nothing's going to happen.
No, I think I think you're being realistic, but you're also doing what, you know, you feel you can do, and then going, and if I can't do this, you know, is this the point where I stop, or do I then start to look into doing research to start to accumulate data that to show, you know, how much better authentic materials is, and then you can keep going further down that rabbit hole, but at what point is it diminishing returns? But I like the neuro-politicking to because that's kind of what you've got to do in the real world, isn't it? You've kind of, if you want to get some stuff done that other people don't want to do, you have to package what you want to get done into something that's going to benefit them as well. It's just, you know, like, did you really think you'd be doing this as a teacher? No.
Well,
but
yeah, I guess not.
You have to expand, you know, to do this.
It's interesting that you mentioned politicking or whatever, because I think the next step, actually, after that, thinking forward, after the exam board, would be the government, and it would be to write to, I don't know, someone. It's either going to be Home Secretary or Minister of Education or someone like that, or even local MP, to make the case to them that having a government-supported exam board that are using a synthetic grammar-based syllabus is not the best way of producing a generation of migrants, workers who can communicate well in English. So I guess that would be the sort of next step in my case. And then you really are getting your feet, your hands dirty, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Could do. And, you know, there's things that make that. You're right. It's not, maybe not what you would imagine to be doing as a teacher, but there are incentives there. I mean, you know, if you end up making a name for yourself as the person who's pushing some agenda like that, it actually can be quite good for your career, can't it? Look at Jamie Oliver, the school meals guy. You know, everyone's going on about Jamie's campaign for school meals all the time, even though I don't think it really had any effect at all. It has been good for his name recognition.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's things that can come of this sort of stuff as well. Will I actually do all that? I don't know, but it's in my head to do something. And in the meantime, you just kind of tolerate it mm-hmm. as best as you can and do the best you can for your students, which is always going to be the case as a teacher. As I said, there's always going to be some compromise.
Mm-hmm.
It's so frustrating when there's this stuff's coming up and you just think, this is so outdated that this stuff should have been gone before I even started teaching.
Yeah.
You know, I started teaching in 2008 and that, you know, there was already a decade of like this authentic materials are the way to go stuff out there. So, you know, it should have already all been gone. And instead we're in 2023. We've almost got ChatGPT teaching everyone. Mm-hmm. And, we're still having these problems.
Yeah, it's a problem that I don't think we will see resolved in our teaching career lifetime. But I never know because, you know, things change so fast. It's so complex. It could just take one person, but they have to be that one person with a specific set of skills in a specific position of power to do something. But, you know, you can always keep trying, but it is like you say, you've really got to think, how much time am I going to invest into this? You know, because we have a very limited amount of time on this planet. And, you know, do you want to be spending that time with your family? Do you want to be spending that time pursuing other passions? Or is this something you want to get into? So you've kind of got to get into that, but also be realistic in terms of, I could invest everything into this and get nothing, and then I'm done. See you later, world. And that's it. And you've got to be okay with that outcome. But that's up to the individual, really.
Yeah, and I mean, again, at a greater level, I think what I really crave is for us to be getting away from this centralized model of society and education and mm-hmm. government. And unfortunately, what it actually seems like is happening is we're going in the other direction. Everything's becoming more standardized, not just on a national level, but on a global level now.
Mm-hmm.
So now the whole world is doing things the same way. I mean, just look at things like IELTS and Cambridge English. They're global entities, you know, and everyone's learning the same way. It's
Do you know
totally
what I find ironic is that, like with IELTS and that, there's you know about this idea of like international English, right? So you know the Brazilian, the Russian, the Chinese, the European, they all speak English and they all speak international English and they all communicate and understand each other well. But you know, you throw in a native speaker, no one understands them, and they don't understand them either. So it's kind of like two divergent English standards, which is I find hilarious. I'm happy that I can walk between both worlds, but it's funny, you know, like when I come across, you know, so like some of my family, and you know they're speaking with you know, like a someone that's international English, and it's like
Tricky.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, who they don't want to change their native English style to communicate, and the international English person's like, well, I've already learned this. Do I really need to learn it this native way as well?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, can we have a compromise? So I find that hilarious. But
I think that's a whole can of worms.
It is another day.
Yeah, it would be a whole other thing. And I've got my thoughts on that are not very clear either.
I actually have a question. Because I feel like we end up diving into that too much, and I want to stick with the mental health. I have a question. So I've done the Big Five, and the personality test, and I've always been a fan of like the Myers and Briggs and doing these sort of things, just to kind of, I like to know myself, and I like to know, kind of my strengths and weaknesses, but also I kind of see areas where weaknesses I can try and build those up, strengths I can play to, yada yada yada. And one of the things I always come across with is this idea that personalities lend themselves to different occupations. So if you are a musician, you're going to be high in creativity, and I can't remember what it was in Big Five. Was it ocean? So openness, you've got to be high in openness or something like that. So those people that are high in openness are going to be, tend to be more creative, tend to be musicians. And then there are people that deal well with stress. So what is that? I can't remember what neuroticism, low in neuroticism. Mm. If you're going to be a surgeon, an emergency responder, a police officer, it behooves you to really think about your personality and think, am I low in neuroticism? Can I handle stress? Is this my temperament? Should we think about teaching in the same way? Because it seems to be a stressful job, and it's a lot of it is instant. It's not like police, where you're dealing with a criminal and it's kind of baked into the cake. It almost feels like the stress with teaching is, it's added in there. It's not baked into the cake. It's just, the demands that are placed, with all the admin and, fitting to the standardization and everything like that, it doesn't seem necessary in the same way that, if you're a first responder, you're dealing with a situation. That is your job. The stress for teaching seems to be added in there. But it's been this way for so long, and I've spoken with so many teachers, and it seemed, and all the books that I've read of teaching, so stressful. Like, should we now consider this to be a stressful job, and therefore if you're going into teaching, should you consider yourself a person that has to be able to deal with stress? What do you think of that train of thought?
I don't think teaching is stressful, to be honest. I think that, and I'm someone who is quite high in neuroticism, but I think if I had like a job as a paramedic, I'm pretty sure I would be more stressed. I don't think I would deal well with that.
Yeah.
If I was in the army or something, I think even more so. I wouldn't deal with that. I think it might just be the case that a lot of people, I think in teaching you get people who are all over the board in neuroticism, but you do seem to get quite a few people who are quite high in neuroticism, especially language teaching. Mm-hmm. And that probably contributes to people saying it's stressful because it feels like it. I mean, it does feel like it to me, but I just think relatively, if I was in the ER or something, it's not that level of stress. And if I was in like financial markets as well, these are the jobs where people lose like 10 billion in a day and then jump out of a window, because it's the stress is so bad they want to die.
Yeah.
So it's that's a different thing, you know. And I'm sure you could probably find the odd occasion of teachers having breakdowns and stuff. Not so much for me. I mean, maybe if you're working in a really terrible state school, I mean, basically take my current complaints about the job being sort of prescriptive and working to a syllabus, and then multiply that by 100, you know, and then you're stuck in some horrible institution. You've got no hope of changing and you've lost your passion for teaching already. And the kids don't do what you say. And it might even be a little bit dangerous, you know, because some of those kids, I remember my school, it was a bit of a zoo sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, like... I say it because, you know, this is the thing that Anthony was talking about, where they should have, you know, like maybe like a counselor within a school, or, you know, they should have like check-in points and stuff. And that's what they do with firefighters, police officers, yeah. Stuff like that. They will say, if you are, because that's what they found. There's, for example, with police shooters, you know, the police that would get into the respond and whatever situation they responded to, there was they shot and killed somebody. This is American statistics, and it was, they found that people that had come, those police officers would often come from a previous call that was actively very stressful, you know, like there was an abuse situation, something involving, you know, like hurt children, something like that, and then and immediately they went into another situation, and that situation ended up, they ended up killing someone, and it was that there was obviously, there was a very high correlation between the two. So they understand these, that they, if they have these specific stressful situations, that these people in these jobs, when they do that, they have to take a bit of time off, or, you know, like not do anything for a certain period of hours. So I'm like, well, isn't that kind of what Anthony was suggesting? You know, like, okay, there's this stressful time here, so let's remove this teacher for a little bit. Or
I think
you're saying, well, you know, a first responder is very different to a teacher, and I agree with that. So, you know, like, how can we compare the two, you know, and how can we make it fair? Because, you know, that someone in the army might be super stressed and going straight back into that, and they're dealing with it okay, but, you know, like the teacher that's, you know, got a really heavy workload is not. So that's why I'm thinking about tempering, you know.
Yeah, I think things do have to be a little bit different in teaching because of the schedule, and cancelling classes is difficult, and having cover is hard to justify financially. So I think the point Anthony made about just being recognised in a human way,
yeah,
by your manager, if you go and you say, God, this situation just happened, just to be able to have some relief. Oh, well, I'll cover the first 45 minutes of your class. You go and have a coffee, sit down, mm-hmm. you know, take a deep breath or whatever. That sort of option, I think, is definitely appreciated and useful. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, that having those kind of things in place is great. Mm-hmm. Taking it to the extent of sort of saying, well, if you have high neuroticism, don't be a teacher. I wouldn't say that, actually. And if we're going to go that personality route, and this is sort of getting onto a slightly different topic, but if we're going to go the personality route, then my preference, maybe it's because I'm high in openness myself, would be to have people really high in openness as teachers. Mm-hmm. And I mean people who are creative and intelligent, and people who want to continually open Pandora's box, because mm-hmm. I think the worst thing that a teacher can be is a mouthpiece for either their own their own dogma or the government or institutional dogma, and I think both of those kinds of teachers just make me feel a bit ill. to be honest.
Well, it's dangerous. Yeah. It's dangerous. And it's something that I've been thinking about extensively because I've been recently reading Richard Feynman's autobiography in preparation for a future teaching master's video. So if you're listening, remember to like, share, subscribe, hit that bell, because that's coming down the pipeline. And one part of that is he's a famous, theoretical physicist, Nobel Prize winner, mathematician, just an amazing genius of a guy, literally a genius. And he is invited down to Brazil to teach physics in Brazil. And physics was kind of like new at the time, theoretical style. And he goes there and he's teaching this physics course and he's asking questions, and he's just, like some questions he asks and he gets answers, and then sometimes he'll ask the same kind of question, but he won't, he's asked the previous question, and he knows from the previous question they know what to do, but he'll ask them to do something, but they don't do it. And what he finds out is that the way that they were teaching is basically the students were memorizing the text. So if he asked them about, I'm not a scientist, so, if he asked them about refraction or something like that, they can explain it really well. But then, he's like, so what happens, if you have this a piece of glass or some sort of gem or jewel and you shine some light in there, and what happens to that? And they're just, he gives an application in real life, and he just gets silence and he doesn't know what to do, and they don't know what to do. And this is all of them. And he chastises the whole Brazil. You'd love it. You should read the book. He chastises the whole of the Brazilian education system. And he didn't say it outright, but what I was thinking was, like, these people, he was literally a person that was, he worked on the Manhattan Project. He created the bomb. He solved what the issue with the Challenger was. They had the Challenger disaster. He was the person that was brought in to find out what went wrong, and he found that out. Now, that was because of his educational background of being really open and just kind of figuring out and tinkering and having good teachers. But the whole of Brazil, there, I think he said there was like two students that were well, and they were briefly educated outside of Brazil. And that's their technology. The whole of Brazil's technology department, for the future, is done, because they're not creating anything new. And if government advisors come to them and talk to them, we want to talk to them about having an atomic bomb, what can you do with this, they won't be able to give any good advice. So it's so dangerous if you really think about it. And if someone is not properly educated, but are under the belief that they are, and then get put in a position where they have to use that knowledge that they don't have. Ah, jeez, come on.
There have been various dystopian science fiction films and TV series which have tackled exactly that. The idea of kind of lost knowledge, where civilization, it's not even an apocalyptic event. It's just the idea that civilization comes to a point where the technology is still there, but finding someone who actually understands how it works is incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a risk sometimes. And I think definitely one of the issues here is, it's like what you said. It's the danger of being too prescriptive, of having people who just regurgitate, of not having your students question things. And, this is something that you just think, like, God, didn't we solve this problem like decades ago at least? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the reason why the education system globally is the way it is it all comes from the British, right? I mean, the mm-hmm. education systems all over the world essentially are modeled on the original kind of British post-industrial revolution Victorian education system. And the reason why that education system was constructed the way it was, it had a very specific purpose, right? And you want to get a lot of people in a classroom, someone at the front, and you're taking people who were from a class that had very low literacy. So, you know, the working class in the 19th century couldn't read and write. Mm-hmm. They had no need to read and write because they were going to be farmers and chimney sweeps and all that nonsense. So they didn't learn those kind of skills. They focused on just practical skills. But then suddenly with the Industrial Revolution and all these factories, you need people to read and write because you need them to count 5 iron ingots, put them in the furnace and take out 1. You know what I mean? They need to have that mathematical ability. And also, when there's a sign that says, do not press the red button, they need to be able to read it and not press the red button, right?
Yeah.
So they needed to very quickly change a generation of people. Mm-hmm. They needed to quickly train this generation of kids to have the skills that would enable them to work in a factory. That's what the Victorian education system was all about. And we don't want them being creative. We don't want people going into a factory and saying, oh, but what does happen if I press the red button? That could be exciting. You know, we don't want that. What we want is, sir, yes, sir, no, sir, red button, no, got it. 1 + 1 = 2. 2 + 2 = 4. That's what they want. So they designed it like that. And it was successful, very successful. And then it spread all over the world. And then all over the world, that's the system we have. We've got the exams. We've got the this is right, this is wrong, stigmatize mistakes, forget creativity, not interested. And since then, the world's moved on. And many, many times people have spoke about how we need to reform education, how we need to make it about creativity, problem solving, you know, soft skills. We've got to bring people into this. And there's always these kind of little, yeah, let's do that. Oh, we're going to have this new thing. Oh, we're going to change this thing up. But the actual fundamental change never happens. And for some reason, we always seem to rubber band back into this is right, this is wrong mentality. And saying that, I think the British education is still one of the most forward-thinking ones in the whole world. You know this yourself. You go to China, and from what you're saying, Brazil, then, you know, the creativity just gets completely beaten out of you. In some cases, literally, because I think they still have corporal punishment in China, right? They still whack the kids in the school.
No, they stopped doing that. It stopped doing it, and it became like a social media thing. You know, people would post their if a teacher would do that, you know, and you know, like they'd get attacked on social media and stuff like that. It is still relatively new, but right. you know within the past decade, but you know,
I mean, because in that situation, it's like you've got teachers who are literally physically abusing kids to make their personality worse.
Yeah.
in my perspective.
Yeah.
I think people who can't think outside the box, and I mean, they're frustrating students, you know, people who have been like that as kids for me, you know, mm-hmm. and I've got a couple now, and, you know, I'm actually there's one in particular I'm thinking of, and I'm losing the battle of bringing her around to my way of thinking. I think mm-hmm. she wants to know the right way to say it. What's the right way? What's the right way of this grammar? What's the right? That's what she wants.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not me, and it's very difficult to convince her otherwise because she's very much in that framework of this is how things work, and she's one of the worst performers in the class. Because she spends all her time translating word for word, speaking her own language with the person next to her, and you know, asking me to write stuff on the board, which is, in my opinion, not that useful for her. So it's
but yeah, it's, you know, she's doing what she's supposed to be doing in that she's trying to do the certificate, and what you're trying to do is allow her to communicate in English. Yeah. She's trying to learn communication. I think I can actually tie the things that we talked about at the beginning and, you know, this last part together. And I think what we need to really think about, and when people think about, is education, is what's the purpose of learning a particular topic. So, you know, like with learning English, the purpose is to communicate. And maybe also people should think about the dangers of that and the utility of that at the same time. So, you know, you gave a good example with the rote, where, you know, read a sign that says don't press the red button, but when it also, if you don't learn the communication aspect of English, what dangers does that lead to? Does that person then get a job, you know, where they become a police officer and they, you know, they're trying to communicate with a person, and because their English level is not fluid enough, they're not creative enough, they can't get that person to, you know, calm down, to not do something dangerous, and all they can do is, you know, speak very plainly and not in a way that's, you know, convincing, etc. And also, you know, now we're moving into AI, we're moving into ChatGPT, where you have to be able to communicate with this AI in a very, you have to have a really deep understanding of communication to be able to actually get the information and the utility out of this AI. If you don't have that, you're not going to get any usefulness, any utility out of it. You know, we talked about this before we came onto the air, that, you know, these people are just saying, just, you know, a standard person is just, you know, asking questions or something like that, when you have to think, well, I need to get this AI to do something for me. I need to be specific and communicate my needs, and think, how am I going to communicate that and put it in a structure so the AI can best, you know, create for you. It's going to be so necessary going forward. And, you know, if people don't have these communication skills, they're done for. Hello? It seems like Rich has
built to the other side, and as we said, we're going to go into that at some point. And I think the other issue, actually, because you were talking about, oh, they might become a policeman and they don't understand people and stuff. I think that's a very, very small possibility, but I think that's unlikely, because I think what tends to happen, if people really stick to that kind of and it's a hard plateau, and they just never get any better from that point. So they'll get to like intermediate, for example, and then they'll just stagnate and they'll just be stuck there forever, because they just keep on. This is in language learning we were talking about specifically. They just keep on in that frame set that they've always used, and they think it's because they need more practice, you know, and, oh, I keep forgetting vocabulary and it's stuff like that. But it's because they've got that kind of word for word thinking, they're focusing on the wrong areas, and they're being too tight about accuracy, about the fact that they have to construct sentences word by word and get everything right. They're trying to make language into a logic puzzle or mathematics.
Yeah, I can actually expand on that a little bit. So there was this program in the US for convicts, where they would give convicts graded readers, and to encourage convicts to, you know, that encourage their literacy, but also they found that it expanded their vocabulary. The more they expanded their vocabulary and had ways to therefore express themselves, the less likely they were to reoffend, and they were actually more better able to integrate into society. So you also have to think that, you know, if you're hitting that plateau, you're also limiting yourself and your expression. So how does that express itself with you? Do you become more frustrated? Does it restrict the jobs that you can get? It changes your mind. For me it must, because you are stuck in a box and you're not able to fully, you know, communicate who you are. So, you know, but these are more like esoteric kind of dangers, right? So it's hard to kind of quantify for many people, but I think your example is much better.
Well, I think the point you made earlier about, and the topic we were talking about earlier, really outside of the context of language learning, just in terms of standard education system, I think that is more poignant. Is that the right word? That's the critical thing, because we could really end up walking into this sort of weird dystopia where we've got people just regurgitating stuff rather than really being kind of a bit more flexible, creative, problem solving about it. And let's just really hope that that's not the way that we go with things, because, well, it'll be bad. it's so stuck.
Communication is so important. If you don't have it, it's bad.
We don't want to go backwards as a society, or even worse. We do not want to be in the situation where no one knows how to program anymore because the AI does it. Or something, you know. It's like if we need to understand the fundamentals of how things work. Otherwise, you can definitely get to a situation where, well, societal collapse or an unsolvable problem brings the end of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah,
you know. So to go back to the idea of teachers and what teachers need to be, you know, yeah. In my opinion, what we really need, we need teachers that are encouraging people to think and question and problem solve and question everything, including what the teacher tells them, and accept that there are more than one ways to skin a cat. And if a student finds another way of doing something that gets the objective, then you reward them. You don't tell them it's wrong because they didn't do it the way you taught them. You know, that kind of attitude. And in my opinion, this is where the controversial thing that I kind of alluded to before, one way of doing that would be to lower job security but increase wages for teaching. So my idea would
be
that,
shit, Rich.
My idea would basically be that every so often teachers have a review of their performance that's done in a way through kind of lesson obs and CPD and things like that. And if it seems that there's a teacher who doesn't really care anymore, isn't really that interested in CPD, just going through the motions or whatever, you know, then you say, well, maybe it's time for you to move on, you know? And I mean, no one's going to be happy with that. That's never going to happen. And it's my kind of radical
maybe
perspective.
Send them on to a teaching retreat sabbatical and find your passion again.
It's quite selfish as well, because I think as someone who's relatively passionate about teaching, really all I want to do is get rid of all those losers who've lost their passion and get a pay rise. But
scorched earth. So,
and it's also inspired by just how many people you have, especially in state teachers. I mean, you remember them when you were at school, surely, even now, you know, just... And they obviously don't give a fuck about teaching, you know? They just want to pay off their mortgage. It's just their job. You're a thorn in their side as a student, you know? So, and one of the reasons for that is because you can't bloody sack teachers. You know, it's one of those jobs that's just like, it's like solid, isn't it? You know, you have to have a really good reason to fire it, to fire an institutional teacher.
Yeah.
And it's the same with you. Universities got it even worse, you know? So that's why I say, and it maybe I'm framing it the wrong way by saying take away job security. I don't mean like we start having 0-hour contract teachers, but I just mean that maybe contracts do need to have a limitation. You know, maybe the idea of a contract for life, maybe we do need to look at that and say, well, maybe we do contracts as 5-year terms instead, you know? Mm-hmm. And that at least gives the institution a chance to say, you know what, this guy for the last fucking 5 years, he's been phoning it in, doesn't give a shit about the kids, you know? I mean, it's serious, isn't it?
Yeah.
That has a serious effect on people's lives.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some bad teachers and it's really fucking discouraging when a teacher takes a disliking to you and doesn't give a shit. And, you know, I mean, when I was trying to do A-levels at my school and I told the IT guy, the A-level course I wanted to do, and he was so resistant to it, you know, and he was really negative about it as well. He was just like, oh, I don't want to teach that one. I'm not going to teach it, blah, blah, blah. The way that he was saying it was so odd. You know, it was like I was being annoying by asking him about it. You know, for me, it was important. If I'd have done that A-level, it would have changed my entire life. I mean,
yeah.
I'm glad I didn't in a way, because I'm not sure that I'd be happy sitting in an office working in IT all the time. But it for, you know, you can see how that would have a very damaging effect on someone. And it's just because that guy, he didn't give a shit. He wasn't interested in his students performing well. It's just his job. And I was making trouble for him by asking about an A-level course that he didn't want to teach.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a kid, you're just like, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't do this. But
I didn't push back. Yeah.
Because they don't understand the broader...
Yeah, it Why? Completely discouraged me to push back. Similar situation on the other poll, actually. And I mentioned I was interested in studying psychology to the like A-level guy. And he was like, oh, yeah, we can look at that. And in the room was was a science teacher who happened to have been my biology teacher. And she said, and she never really liked me that much. She thought I was a bit weird. And I was a bit of a nerd. And she wasn't. And she said, oh, psychology, that's my area. I graduated in animal psychology. That's not really your thing, is it, Rich? You're more into your maths and physics. Totally put me off it. Never looked at psychology again. And ever since, I've been fascinated about psychology. I could have had a fucking A-level in it, but no, because of that comment. So, you know, that's what I mean. You know, yeah. Teachers are fucking important.
Yeah.
And when a kid expresses some sort of passion or interest, we need teachers who are gonna encourage that. Kind of no matter what, we can't have this sort of negative shutdown, it's just a job mentality. So yeah, maybe my idea is a bit radical, pulling the rug out from my own feet, actually, as a teacher. I actually have one of those cushy, safe-ass institutional jobs right now
yeah.
that I could sit in for the rest of my life and actually build up a pension if I wanted to. Yeah, no, I don't know if that's what we need, because somehow we've got to weed them out. How do you do it, or how do you ensure that your teachers are, you know, I don't know. Anyway,
no,
rant over. I think.
I agree. I you know, I'm not sure the extent, but it is the rich way. What I would like is to encourage people that are listening, that are watching, to leave your comments and let us know what you think of Rich Scorched Earth policy of, you know, strapping collars to teachers, and if they don't teach very well, you know, they buzz them on the balls or something like that. You know, what would you do? What do you agree? Any other thoughts about what we've touched on in this particular podcast? Let us know. Remember to like, share, subscribe. The reason to do that is because it encourages others to come and give us a listen, and, you know, it gives us more resources to actually, you know, do this for longer and for making it better for all of you that are listening as well. Final awesome. Thoughts, Rich?
Yeah, final thought is Bon Jovi. It's actually a shortened version of Bon Giovanni,
okay,
which means good John in Italian. So when you say Bon Jovi, you're just saying good John.
Oh, okay then.
All right, Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi, everybody. If you're looking for more information from myself, you can go to teamteacherchina.com. We've got a whole bunch of materials, PowerPoints that you can use instantly in the classroom. We've got a Team Teacher China YouTube channel where we have videos teaching you how to use those materials. Team Teacher English, where we put those materials into a video form for self-study. And Team Teacher Baby, where I take my experience as a teacher and put that into parenting.
And go to YouTube.com slash Professor Rich to see some English teaching. You can catch me weekly live streams on Oxford Online English YouTube channel. Oh, and also you can do a YouTube search for POG space UK and you would get my alpha version of my new gaming channel, which actually just have some trial content on there at the moment. You can email us here at eltunderthecovers@gmail.com if you have anything you'd like to contribute to the show.
Smash that like button, share and subscribe.
And watch 100% of the video and don't click off. Thank you.
Bye.